I'm very happy now to welcome Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser. They are from Singing Frogs Farm in Sebastopol, California. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you two are a living work, and your farm are an example of the proposition that managing soil to maximize organic matter in the soil increases the productivity of farmland, increases farmers' incomes. You guys have an amazing situation. Your crop yields are way, way higher than comparable farms in the area. Your income is way, way higher than comparable farms in the area. What are you doing differently?
Some of the basics are that we are focusing on the soil first and foremost. And Mother Nature is secondary, and tertiary is the human food crop. If we can build back soil and build back the environment and the ecology, that makes the food production easier. And so we have really focused on doing no-till vegetable crop production, and it's non-mechanized no-till, not a tractor involved here. It's all hand labor. And we are doing it in such a way that has brought back our soil organic matter health. It's increased it by over 300% in just 5 short years at a deep depth of 12 inches. So the biotic life in the soil is doing the work for us.
So you don't till the soil. They've been tilling the soil since the Bible.
That they have.
Before, yes.
And that's part of the problem. That's why our soil organic matter in most agricultural land is so depleted. And all of that carbon has gone up in the atmosphere. When you till the soil, you're bringing oxygen down, you're breaking it up, and that carbon then is released into the atmosphere. So that's actually a large part of the problem with climate change, is that the carbon has gone from the soil up into the air, and it's not being brought back down.
So if you don't till the soil, what do you do instead? How do you plant your crops?
It's both incredibly simple, it's almost ridiculously simple, and very complicated. What it comes down to is when the vegetable crop is finished, like cauliflower, we simply pull it out of the ground or cut it off at the base, compost that green matter, let the roots die in place, throw down new compost, and transplant in the next crop. So our turnover from one standing crop to the next standing transplant crop is all of a few hours, not days or weeks or months. It's a few hours. But the complexity is that you're managing many, many different systems involved to make sure that it actually functions properly. And that's where years of experience have come in handy to understand how best to just transition from one crop to the next to make sure that you do have the appropriate nutrients and all the other contextual issues for good crop growth.
So years of experience, but you did this in 5 short years. It's How been, did you learn this, all this?
It's been about 8 years.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we've really been doing full no-till on many fields for 5 or 6 years now. And it was trial and error at the beginning. A lot of it was breaking thumbs and fingers and knees on machinery and just cursing and swearing at the rototiller and the tractor and the disc and just not wanting to be killing snakes and songbird nests and other things that were on the ground in the fields that we're plowing and tilling. And it was realizing that even a walk behind rototiller would create a totally earthworm-free bed for the next year because it would just kill the earthworms.
And so you want earthworms because earthworms, well, what do earthworms do?
Earthworms are one of a myriad of different biotica that are living in the soil. They are just the largest ones. They will take plant matter, usually the dead roots that are often still pumping water. They'll just eat right down it, meanwhile pooping little bits of fertilizer as they're going down. So they're helping turn that soil into fertilized. They're also helping aerate. You've also got all of the other microbes, all of the bacteria, all of the fungi, which are excruciatingly important in having good soil.
It's so interesting because here at the Kivira conference, and I'm certainly not a farmer, I'm not even a gardener, but, you know, watching what people are doing, you know, instead of using devices to aerate the soil, you use earthworms, which means you don't have to do anything. Instead of using fertilizers, you use compost. You, instead of using fungicides, you let the natural fungi take root so you don't need fungicides for the bad fungi. I mean, it's like you just let nature do it.
In fact, the compost isn't necessarily our nutrients. The compost isn't what feeds the soil as much as the no-till feeds the soil. And having constant plant matter in your beds. If you are always growing green living plants in your soil and you never have bare dirt, those green plants are shading and protecting the soil from direct sun and direct wind. They are also photosynthesizing, and then the photosynthesis is turned into chemical energy that is exuded through the roots to feed the soil biota. Meanwhile, as the plants grow and die, the roots that are dying are also eaten by the soil biota. So the photosynthesis and the plant roots are constant food for the soil biological life, which in turn feed the nutrients back to the plants. So anytime you have bare soil, it's exposed to the wind and sun and rain, and it doesn't have photosynthesis happening, and there aren't any plant roots to feed the soil. So bare soil is the worst crime you can do in building back organic matter. Having constant plants that are green and living in the ground is the best way to protect your soil, hence why we can transfer from one standing crop to the next standing crop in a matter of hours instead of weeks.
And so you can have more crops per year.
In addition, more crops per year, which means more revenue per year. So we're doing 3 to 7 crops per bed per 12-month cycle, whereas most organic vegetable farms are only doing 1 or 2 crops per 12-month cycle.
And on top of all that, you're mitigating climate change.
Majorly. We've brought our organic matter from a 2.4% organic matter at a 12-inch depth up to about a 7, 8, 8.5% organic matter at a 12-inch depth. So that's all carbon that's been sequestered from the atmosphere.
And it's not going anywhere.
Nope.
Very, very interesting. We're talking to Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser about their farming techniques. In addition to all of that, you don't weed because there are no weeds. This is even beyond my... you're straining credibility.
Isn't it great to be able to say as a farmer, we don't weed?
There's a very, very minor amount of weeding. But what's happening is because after we take out a crop and before we put in the next crop, we're putting down a layer of compost on the top. And so that's working a little bit as a mulch. So that's covering the weeds that are already there. And then because we use 99% exclusively transplants that are pretty large transplants. They're about 5 inches tall.
That you're growing in a greenhouse?
Yeah, you've grow them ourselves.
Greenhouse and open nursery, depending on the season. We'll put them in, and they've already got a 5-inch head start on any weeds that need to germinate and then break through that mulch layer that we've laid down. So yes, there are a few weeds in there, but they're not doing very well because they're so outcompeted with the plants.
Yeah.
In addition to that, because the plants are so healthy, they're just strong and robust. So a little weed here and there doesn't bother them.
You have characterized your work as farmers as exporting nutrients, meaning you're selling food. You're selling nutritious food, and as is coming out more and more, the better your soil is, the more nutritious your food is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, I mean, you're cutting it off and selling it at farmers markets or at CSAs or whatever. How are you, I mean, do you have to replenish that nutrition into the soil?
Yeah. So as a farmer that's exporting thousands of pounds of food off the farm every week, you can only do that for so long before you run out of nutrients. And when you look at cities are a place that we are sending antibiotics and energy and food and materials and resources into cities, and then they're generating waste. And we're good at recycling the plastics, or we're good at recycling the paper and the metals and bringing those back into production, but what about all of the food residue, all the compostables from people's kitchen scraps and yard waste that is going out there into landfills and creating methane or nitrogen leachate going into the oceans to pollute those and create dead zones, or going into the atmosphere creating greenhouse gases? If we can capture all that biological material from the cities and urban areas and bring it back to the farmers who produce the food, then you can close the nutrient loop, and you have small, highly intensive farms like ours in city centers, in suburban areas, that can produce food for that community and then recycle that community's nutrients back onto the farm, and you close the nutrient loop so there is no leakage. Because leakage of nutrients is simply pollution. And how do we stop that pollution and create a tight system so that we have really high productivity without pollution?
Do those systems exist, recycling the nutrients that are being wasted and that are basically waste in cities?
Many cities are now doing a lot of composting processes. But unfortunately, because most of our farms are still many hundreds of acres in size or larger, and they're often many hundreds of miles away from cities, it means that all the food has to be trucked all the way into the city, and then the biological material has to be trucked out of the city to a compost facility, composted, and trucked back to the farm again. So you have this huge three-legged loop of semi-trucks and diesel fuel, as opposed to getting small, highly intensive farms right in the communities where the people eat the food and you can create the compost and grow the food.
So in our community, we have a really a wonderful system where we have not only curbside garbage pickup, but we also have curbside recycling, and then we also have curbside green waste. And a lot of that is lawn waste, you know, clippings and so forth. But more recently, people have been able to put their vegetable scraps from the kitchen in there as well. So that goes to a municipal composting facility that is cooked at a very high temperature. In fact, it's certified organic, and then it's tested for chemical residues. And then that's the compost that we bring onto our farm. And that's about two-thirds of the compost that we use on our farm. About a third of the compost we use, we produce on-site. And that's the green matter from the plants that we have already harvested.
So the kind of soil that you have put a lot of time into cultivating, and I love this idea of cultivating soil as opposed to just cultivating cauliflower or whatever.
Exactly,
you got it.
That soil is very resilient, and there are some very dramatic examples of what happens when you have resilient versus not very resilient soil, soil with lower organic matter in it, during times of not enough rain or too much rain.
Definitely there's an issue with water right now in the West. Texas has gone through severe droughts. California is in a severe drought. Most of the West is drier than it has been. By building back the organic matter levels in our soil from 2.4% up to 8% or more, we have gone from using 2 to 3 hours of drip irrigation every other day. Originally, when we were tillage, now that we're no-till, we're using only about 1 hour of drip irrigation every 5 to 7 days. So we have reduced our water use almost by down to 1/10 or 1/8 of what it used to be to produce the same crops that we used to. That's because of the no-till and the organic matter levels. In addition, just to talk about that percentage of organic matter in the soil, when you have, let's say it was 2.4% organic matter and now we're at 8%, well, every 1 percentage point of organic matter that you have in your soil increases that soil's ability to hold water by 16,000 gallons per acre in the top 12 inches. So if we've gone from 2.4 up to 8% organic matter, we have increased the ability of our soil to hold almost 100,000 gallons of plant available water per acre in the top 12 inches, which means our water is more efficiently used. It's not lost to deep subsoil layers or not evaporated and transpired off the soil. It is far more efficiently used, which means we're using 1/8 of the water we used to use.
And a large part of that is the soil is so much more porous, so we're not having runoff. It's seeping down, and it's a sponge, and it's seeping down. And especially with climate change, we're having much more severe rain events. It's not, you know, spread out over a long time of little events. It's these big, intense downpours, and so we're able to hold that a little bit better.
And during those big, intense downpours, some people lose all their crops.
Yes,
yes,
we've actually had neighbor farms who. We had 11-inch rainfall in a 36-hour period, and it was the first rainfall after a 6 or 7 month dry season, and it was an inundation. And our neighbors, a few hundred yards around the corner, in their own words, they had 100% crop loss of their vegetables. And they were doing typical tillage organic systems, and we're doing no-till organic, and our no-till, we had zero crop loss on the same rain event that they had 100% crop loss.
Now, what is the role of animals on your farm?
Animals, we used to use a lot more animals on our property when we had more rotational cover cropping in the winter and vegetables in the summer. So we used to have a lot of chickens that would come through in the winter with the cover crops, and that was great for our egg laying. We still have a milking goat. We've got a guard llama. We've got sheep. We've got laying hens, just not as many as we used to. We have ducks for pond management, and we have our farm dog and our farm cats for rodent control. So we have lots of animals on the farm, but they don't as heavily interact with the vegetables as one might think, because the vegetable production system functions beautifully if you keep it going. if you ever stop and take a break, that's when the weeds come in and all the other pressures come in, and you lose the organic matter in your soil because it's been left bare with dying plants on it. By keeping living plants in our soil all the time and constantly turning over vegetables as fast as we can, we're actually increasing soil health simply by using it. The more you use it, the better you protect it, the healthier it is. And so that doesn't leave a lot of room for the animals to come into the vegetable fields, but they certainly come down the roadways and around the periphery.
So all of this is done on a 2.5 acre, well, the farm is larger than that, but you're farming about 2.5 acres and making a living, having other people who work on your farm who are also making very nice livings. Is this, this is obviously incredibly important, an incredibly important example, and there are many of them, but here you are doing this example. Your neighbors aren't necessarily doing it. Is it scalable to larger farms?
We get this question a lot of, you know, let's scale this up. And part of the our answer is why? Because one of the issues is that when we have urban areas, we need to have small farms in and around it. And how much better than to have a very productive farm? Another answer is because we are so highly intensive and productive, even though we're only 2.5 acres, we're producing what a 15 to 20, maybe even 25 acre farm would be through more traditional methods. So there's different ways of considering that.
We are scaled up simply by the intensivity of our productivity.
Right.
And therefore, we can be closer into the urban cores to keep those nutrients local and keep the transportation costs out of the equation, mm-hmm. and have people right there working on the farm, eating from the farm, all in that community. So we don't need to be large. We can fit into any little 1 acre or 3 acre pocket in a city or town.
All of our customers are within 20 miles of us.
Now, how did you learn all this? It was all trial and error? I mean, did you study?
It's interesting because it's very different than the traditional box of farming. And there's the traditional box of farming, which includes tillage, as you said at the beginning of the program. And then there's also soil science. And if you go and look at soil science, it is very well known for many, many years that tillage is bad, that no-till is the way to go. But people just haven't known how to do this. So I think the fact that we came from a non-direct route was very helpful in this.
I was going to say soil scientists aren't farmers, and farmers aren't soil scientists.
Correct.
So the soil scientists know that tillage is bad, but farmers are still farming the way we have for 10,000 years. Neither one of us was a farmer.
No.
We actually were very much a background in ecological land management and sustainable land use management and natural resources, and so we came at it from how do we create a healthy, viable ecosystem?
Mm-hmm.
And then the economic part was, well, but I also have to make money, so let's grow food. And honestly, once you create that healthy, viable ecosystem, the food production was easy.
Now, your neighbors have 100% crop loss during a terrible rainstorm. You have 0%. Are people flocking to you to learn what you guys are doing and trying to imitate it?
Yes
and no.
Well, yes, we've had over 850 people come on paying farm tours in this year alone, 2014, and many of them were young farmers who want to learn how.
It's really the young farmers that we have the inroads with that they're seeing this model and saying, wow, this looks really great. But farmers who already have purchased their equipment, have already figured out a way that works for them, you know, throwing that all up in the air and trying something new is incredibly scary. And
I wouldn't expect them to go whole hog 100% change on a system that's working for them. But if we can capture that new generation of young farmers just starting to farm and they happen to hear us speak or come to on a farm tour, they completely open their eyes to a whole different way of approaching farming. And we immediately get them coming back for a second and third and fourth and fifth farm tour so they can apply what they learned to their own system. And it's working. We have other people who are doing a phenomenal job of no-till along with us.
How generalizable is the way you're working to other latitudes, other climates, other soil systems, and so on?
There are certainly a couple of things that maybe aren't. We are in a Mediterranean climate. We're in Sonoma County in California. We do have some early frost dates. They are light frosts. However, this is really soil science and soil biology. And that said, it works everywhere. Our background is in West Africa. We've got a young farmer who's doing this up in the foothills of the Sierra on clay and rock soil, and he's having wonderful results. So we believe that it can be done many different places, and it will need slight adaptations here and there.
But soil science is universal. Soil biology is universal.
Well, and I think the thing that, I mean, you can say other farms have made their investments and it's working for them, but the carbon sequestration is such a huge part of this. I mean, the potential for soil to mitigate climate change is, I mean, you look at these other things, it's like, oh, let's inject carbon dioxide down to the bottom of the ocean. Are you kidding me? Or
no
let's
way.
Inject it into caves or whatever. This is not only, I mean, wherever else you inject it, it's going to come back up eventually, is very likely. But the other thing is, this is actually a win-win because you're taking it out of the air and you're making better soil. It's not just like you're putting it in a vault somewhere.
Exactly. It's absolutely win-win. In fact, our soils across the planet have lost over half their carbon, if not more, in the past couple hundred years of farming. And that has been a really significant impact on our productivity and especially on the nutrient density of our food and the water resiliency of our soils. So we have much less resiliency to drought because of the degradation of carbon in our soils. And yet the European Union and the United Nations, they've done some meta studies and they found out that looking at all the different sectors of the economy, agriculture has by far the greatest capacity to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions of any other sector. And agriculture is the cheapest form of greenhouse gas mitigation. So not only is agriculture the cheapest and the most capacity to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, but by doing so through no-till, you're actually just increasing the nutrient density of the food you grow. You're reducing the water resource use. You're increasing labor on a farm, so increasing employment. You're increasing revenues. I mean, everything good increases, and everything negative falls away.
Yeah, it seems like the only losers in this game are the people who are producing agricultural chemicals.
Yeah, and sure. Yes.
Well put. And also, I mean, just from the things that he said there, you know, if you want to talk about sustainability, people talk about the three different parts of sustainability. You've got the environmental, and we're doing that through, you know, capturing greenhouse gases and producing food and habitat restoration and lots of different things like that. But we're also doing that socially by hiring people year-round on our farm, which is fantastic, and paying them good wages.
So they have job security.
They have job security. Two of our employees, their wives are having babies in the next 4 months, so we're really excited about that. And then the last one, which is often left when we're talking about environmentalism, is, you know, the economic aspect, but we've made that work as well. So
I guess the reason that the question about scale keeps on coming up and is so important is because there are many large-scale farms that probably aren't going to be broken up into six-acre plots. And large-scale farms have that much more land and therefore that much more ability, theoretically, to sequester carbon.
I don't disagree with that, but I also know that the new generation of young farmers who might adopt the practices that we're doing, they often are very suburban and urban. That's where they came from. That's where they want to live. And the issue for them is often cost of living, the cost of the land value especially. And if we can start producing this kind of revenue per acre for young farmers, they can begin to buy actual land and pay it off as well and make a livelihood right there in the towns and cities where they can close that nutrient cycle, close that loop, and keep everything localized and make a living at it. And so, yes, we have 100-acre farms way out in the boonies that could still be producing maybe the grains or maybe the cattle and the beef, but we can get down to vegetables and food right in our towns and cities really well.
And let me just also say that there are no-till ways of doing grain production, and there are no-till ways of doing ranching. And those are a very different thing.
But also doing, fantastic.
They're fantastic, and
yes,
they're extremely important. It's just that right now there's very, very, very few people who are doing no-till vegetable production because it's more challenging because it's a very complex system.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. Understanding a complex system, understanding environmental science and ecosystems, as opposed to a kind of more simple plant, fertilize, harvest,
right,
is the key.
Yes, absolutely.
Paul and Elizabeth Kaiser are from Singing Frogs Farm in Sebastopol, California. For more information, you can go to their website,
which is singingfrogsfarm.com.
Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much
for having us.